See a lot of new faces in the crowd. There's a buzz in the crowd. This is going to be, if you haven't been on Senate before, this is going to be more exciting than I can tell you for all those new faces. But we do welcome you on such a beautiful day. What a nice piece of weather we're having, and hope you're off to a good start in the semester. So we will begin the Senate meeting for September 19th, 2019. And first up, we have some information items, and I'll just read a couple of these to you. So our Senate parliamentarian, we're happy that Mike Latcha has agreed to serve. Senate secretary will be Dicka Bervin, who's really writes fast, and we appreciate that. Appointment of Senate Elections Committee, Joe Rieger is the chair. Zainal Al-Salman and Debatash Debna, appreciate you doing that. So next up, we're gonna have a presentation about South Foundation Hall. I'm sure everyone is aware that there is a significant project undertaking at South Foundation Hall. So Tricia Westergaard's here to talk about this some as it impacts scheduling, but also we have some reps from Stantec, and I'm gonna introduce Steve Zmick from Facilities. Steve, you're here to introduce Stantec. Thanks, Steve.
Hi, everybody. I'm going to turn it very quickly over to Patrick and Sammy from Stantec, our architects representatives. Got a great, great building to show you.
Thank you. That was very quick. Diving right into the project at South Foundation Hall, this was a capital outlay project submitted to the state for funding to help resolve a significant issue, that is a need for general purpose classrooms on campus. South Foundation Hall currently has 39 classrooms, and as you see as we go into this, this project will do two things. One, it will right-size the classrooms to better fit with the enrollment sizes for the sections, but it will also increase the classroom count from 39 up to 50, which is where the target is for the budget we've got to work with. This really started with a little bit of research into, we used the fall 2018 scheduling data to really take a look at how South Foundation Hall was being used, how we could find a way throughout this very extensive renovation and addition to get more classrooms into the space. 72% of the sections that occur in South Foundation Hall have an enrollment of 32 or fewer students. Only 22% go between 33 and 48, yet 71% of those 71% of all sections in South Foundation Hall occur in classrooms with 48 seats. And that's 48 tablet armchairs in very small rooms. What that looked like was you've got a good room utilization. They're in use quite a bit, but when they are in use, on average, only about 49% of the seats are full. So that told us that one of two things. One, the rooms really are too small to hold that number of students, and two, there are just way too many seats in these spaces. We took a look at that, and one of the first steps is really to look at the quality of the classroom space. Those rooms, the typical size room there, isn't actually, from a flexibility standpoint, from a furniture rearrangement standpoint, the existing rooms don't even work that well for modern learning spaces for 32 seats. So that's really driving, right now we're looking at the design, removing most, if not every single wall between rooms in that building. It will be a complete gut renovation. Our goal here was to bring an additional natural light, to right-size these spaces, to provide more flexible furniture, and to upgrade the technology so it's standardized between all the classrooms and it is more user-friendly, to make sure that when class is over that there is space in this building for student collaboration, that the building reaches for LEED sustainability goals, that it meets safety and security requirements of the university. We have met with university police, and we've looked through the building and are incorporating their recommendations into the design, and that it is going forward universally accessible, and an inclusive space. When we looked at the resizing of the building, the existing building, but also the addition, the blend was to really get away from the 48-seat classrooms. We're looking at providing a handful of rooms that seat 20 seminar-sized spaces, more size for like graduate programs and smaller enrollment classes, a handful of 24-seat classrooms, again, flexible seating. The sweet spot for this building will really be 32-seat classrooms, 28 of those, and then from 42-seat, 48-seat classrooms, 10 of those, and then providing two amply sized 72-seat classrooms. The goal here was to hit 50 classrooms, and again, to make sure that there was space for collaboration and there was space for classroom support. In looking at some of the precedents that we kind of came into this with, one of the thoughts was to provide classrooms that supported students not only facing front, but also really talking to each other. When we're looking at the smaller rooms, the 20-seat rooms, a bit more of a flexible arrangement. The phrase lounge classroom has been bantered about, but it's really something that encourages more interaction between students in those smaller groups. So these are some of the different approaches that we've talked about. When we're getting into the 24-seat classroom, making sure that we've got both traditional classrooms, but also spaces that can be converted for active learning to really allow the students to change their focus from lecture to group work to individual work without having to rearrange the furniture, making sure that the technology infrastructure is in place when the building is complete, but also will allow for modification without a lot of investment in different and in additional infrastructure. We want to make sure that the furniture is mobile enough that it can be rearranged, light enough that it can be moved out of the way in case there's a session that wants to work in more of a classroom in the round approach, and that allows for, again, lecture mode to group work mode, as you see in that large photo there. One of the things that we're talking about when we're standardizing on furniture for the space is to look at giving students posture options. So there's the ability to sit, there's the ability to stand. If you want to sit at a taller cafe table height, one of the benefits of looking at things with multi-height desks is it improves sight lines without having to constantly be looking around another student. Making sure that wherever we can in the existing building that we're providing collaborative space, smaller breakout spaces, not unlike some of the things you see in the engineering building, but also tucking in spaces like the large image to the left there into a larger collaborative space that would allow students to use the furniture, rearrange it to meet their needs, but also to support really showcasing the different academic programs and take on different functions, including during summer use. And with that, I will turn it over to Sammy on the design.
Thank you. So with those factors kind of driving it, you know, the quality of the space Patrick mentioned, and then the different classroom types that we've bantered on, upgrading them, bringing them into kind of current teaching situations, the plan for the design of the building is to do an addition onto the south side of the existing South Foundation Hall. So as Patrick mentioned, the existing South Foundation Hall will be a full gut renovation. We're saving the structure, but not much else. So it's going to give us the flexibility to really update everything and make everything really current. And then the addition to the south will be situated onto that kind of formal quad space that you guys have on campus, really nicely facing that and kind of providing a porch to that space. So you'll see some of that in our renderings as I move through our presentation here. So getting into the floor plans and what that means for the building and the space, the idea is to eliminate with the design the existing fishbowl, as I think it's referred to, at the north end of South Foundation Hall, and really recreate that space inside at that end. So the pink space you're seeing at the far end there is kind of a new open collaborative space on each level, and it'll read that way to the exterior of the building. Throughout the length of the existing building, it'll be, you know, double-loaded corridor with classrooms, but those pink spaces, again, are these pause points for students to sort of collaborate in between classes, wait for classes, touch down. And again, the classrooms here are kind of color-coordinated by size, so I don't have a key on here, but the purple are all those kind of 32 sweet spot. with some flexibility built in for rearrangement of furniture and things like that. As we go down to the addition, there's a new kind of core that where the old and the new meet that are all of your service spaces, your elevators, your circulation, your restrooms. And then the addition stretches out, again, facing that quad with, again, these pink spaces representing the open collaboration. So a really great open collaborative space for students looking out onto that formal quad on campus. As we jump up to the other floors in the building on level two, again, very similar in the existing layout. One of the issues that we have with the existing building is it's a very, very low floor-to-floor height, so that means that the classroom spaces feel kind of low and cramped at the ceiling heights we can get. So one of the benefits of the addition is to put the larger spaces, the larger classrooms in there to get a greater ceiling height, much like this space, that feels a lot nicer to be in. So in doing that, there's not really a second floor to the addition, except for this mezzanine level that'll be a really great collaborative space overlooking the space below. On the third floor, again, we've got that really heavily packed with classrooms in the new addition, some great collaboration space spread throughout, and these little niches for students to wait for class in and study in between class. So what does that mean for the exterior of the building? What does that start to look like as a piece of architecture? We really want to celebrate the fact that South Foundation Hall is the first building on campus and not lose that piece of its history. So the building begins to tell a story about the past and the present and OU into the future. So materiality-wise, we start to represent the past by with the use of brick, which is what you see a lot of throughout campus. It's very contextual to what you have throughout a lot of your buildings on campus. But some of the newer buildings on campus start to introduce metal in a bunch of different ways, like the engineering building, the renovation to this building. So we're using both of those materials as a combination of telling this past and present. And the past starts to be represented through this kind of veil that goes over the existing South Foundation Hall and the metal tying it together to be one unified building. So what does that look like? This is kind of, again, capturing it from Meadowbrook, the view of the building and the addition. So as you can see on the far side of the image there, that's that new fishbowl element I'm talking about. We're taking that little one-story addition off the end, but creating a great, you know, lots of natural light space at the north end still there. You can see in the existing South Foundation Hall, there's kind of this language that references the old with the vertical windows there, but much more up-to-date and contextual to the times now. And then the addition as a wing off the south end. So again, that kind of is the view of this new fishbowl element with great collaboration space, great point of entry from this end. And as we move around the building to the addition, this is the view kind of approaching off that circle drive. That's the kind of the main drive onto campus, facing out to the quad. And you can see the great two-story collaboration space that'll be for students to use in between classes and really work actively in. We also have this language that starts to look like a front porch for students to step outside during classes. They'll be or after classes and work outside to get some light and some daylight in between their back-to-back classes. As we go around the building to the east, so coming from the diagonal across the quad, you can see some of that same multi-story collaboration space, but we also get a sense of entry from the east end. So, you know, if you're coming from Oakland Center across, there'll be an entry point there as well. And that reads it the same way with these glass areas that are really signifier of entry and active collaboration space that lets people outside the building see how active and activated the building is on the inside with all the students there. And a nice night shot for you of that same space. It'll be all lit up. Again, lots of students working in that collaboration space and really activating the building at night. Just a couple more from you. We also thought it was really important to frame views back to Elliott Tower, which is, you know, a significant landmark on campus. And really, this living on that circle drive at the front of campus being a very prominent face of campus as visitors enter OU. So I think with that, I know Tricia's got some to talk about with South Foundation Hall too, but I think we can take some questions if there are any. Yes? No? Any questions? Yes?
What's the timeline on the construction?
So I believe the idea is that the building will be closing for the beginning of May. And what do we have worked out? Is it 18 months? 18 months construction from start to end to get everything wrapped up from there. Anything else? Yes.
Very short. Let's see if I get this. Hello.
Hi.
So with the construction, I saw that you mentioned you were getting rid of, like, not getting rid of, but renovating the fishbowl area. That's, like, a really common area that students use for, like, tabling, promoting student organizations. Will there still be tables and stuff available for students to use?
Yeah, so again, the actual physical building outside of, you know, the one-story space outside of the existing building there will be eliminated, but we're creating a new space on the interior that'll have a lot of the same feel, and I'm sorry there's not furniture in there, but yes, there will be a lot of collaboration furniture, flexible tables, flexible seating in that space for students to use very much in the same way. Okay. Hopefully better meet the needs of the students than
Beautiful.
The current space.
Thank you.
Joe Rieger, I have two questions. The first question is when you get ready to put these different desk and module furniture, will you be bringing in people who actually teach in the building to see if it functions? Because we've had classrooms designed that don't really always function for the way we use it. And I see a lot of combined tables and there's no individual chairs. And there are classes where people do want their students to sit separated from each other. So will you be doing some of that to make sure that furniture actually works for us?
We absolutely do want that feedback, and that's part of why we're, you know, sharing it with you all now. We had another presentation last week. So absolutely, if you have thoughts about it, we want to hear it. I'm not sure what we've got built into the actual process as a formal meeting at this time, collected, but yes, we absolutely want your feedback on that and hope we can get some.
I think it would be useful once we see what the size of the spaces are and what you're planning to, if you could set up some rooms for us, because my department teaches almost everything in that building, and I'm thinking some of those, the way those rooms are set up, would not function as well for us as others.
Okay. Yeah, and at this stage right now, we're working through what's the phase in design called schematic design, and primarily our goal right now actually is to get this back in front of the state to have them approve to move forward to the next step. Typically for the interior design portion, that conversation comes next.
Okay.
So we'll work with facilities to make sure that there's an opportunity to have that discussion.
That would definitely be great.
Yeah, none of the furniture by any means has been selected
okay.
or finalized or decided on. This is kind of a thought about how it starts to feel in the space and what can fit inside to inform the architecture.
My second point, and this is not really a question, but so this classroom that we teach a huge amount of our classes in is going to be offline for 18 months, and it looks like we're only getting 10 additional classrooms, and that a large section of it is going to be left open on top of the two large classrooms. And it feels like at a university that we're always struggling for classroom space, I'm curious as to why we're not going to use that second floor on the addition to actually put more rooms in, since that's really our biggest need.
And there actually is no second floor on the addition. Because the existing building, as Sammy mentioned, with 12 feet from floor to floor, the space that's required above the ceiling for the ductwork, piping, electrical, all the mechanical work, doesn't work in 12 feet anymore and still meet modern air change standards and mechanical standards. The adjacent building, the goal here was we needed to align it, obviously, on the first floor, and we had to align it on the third floor. Because there's no way to align the two, what you end up with in the addition is just taller than normal spaces. To say that there is no second floor, it's just there's no room for a second floor in that building.
Yes.
As it is, the addition actually is going to be slightly taller than the existing building just to get that second floor of classrooms in there. That's why we pushed all the 48 and 72 seat classrooms into that building, because to put 48 in the existing one would be, I think the word we've used is oppressive with big rooms and low ceilings.
Yeah, it's a little misleading, conceptual to think about, but It was always intended to be a two-story building. That's what the budget can afford, and that's the space that's been proposed to the state. The challenging part with that is that the existing building is three levels, and again, that floor-to-floor height is the challenge. So we wanted to make sure that we weren't only aligning floor one and three and having two basically just dead end into nothing at the end of the existing building. So that's why we've kind of started to work. It had to be taller to begin with to get those ceiling heights and everything we mentioned, but it's not really the budget cannot afford, and there is actually never been a plan for a second floor. So the mezzanine is kind of a bonus that we're squeezing in to make the design work better so that level two isn't just dead-ending into nothing from the existing building.
Leila Gassous, Mechanical Engineering. I sort of second Joe's comment. I mean, we had the experience with the engineering center and, you know, it has great open spaces, but at the same time, we are limited in terms of the number of classrooms in there. And that's one thing that we wish we had more of, particularly now, you know, we really can't teach that many courses in the building. So if there are ways to incorporate more classrooms, I think that would be beneficial. The second thing is just based sort of on my experience teaching in a south-facing classroom with lots of glass, is making sure that in your design you're incorporating things for shade on those hot days. You know, the rooms, even with the HVAC and all that, can get pretty warm, but also you can get quite a bit of glare from the sun. And so sort of thinking about that in terms of the orientation of any boards, any displays, you know, sometimes there can be a lot of glare that interferes with the, you know, proper functioning of the classroom. And I had a third comment, and now I can't remember what that was. I noticed, like in some of the renovations, like sometimes I teach in Dodge Hall, and you'll have classrooms where they put the projector, you know, the distance where it is relative to the screen. You end up with a very small, you know, whatever, that white screen that comes down. So you have a projector, but whatever you're projecting on there is relatively small. So as you're thinking in terms of the electrical and where you're putting things, try to maximize that so that when we are projecting, we can have things as big as possible so that the text doesn't look too small on there for those of us who do use projectors. And I don't know at what point in the design that comes into play, but it involves, I think, a bunch of electrical work, and so better think of that ahead of time.
So. Absolutely. So, you know, glare and lighting is something we always take into account in every project. There's lots of ways to mitigate that with shading devices or different types of glass to use, so that's absolutely being considered on those south-facing classrooms. And we're working with technical support or classroom support as well to, you know, figure out the technicalities of all the projector equipment and any sort of teaching equipment, that technology that are in those classrooms. So absolutely being considered. Thank you.
Eddie Chen from Mathematics and Statistics. I seems to think, okay, for the new building, it seems that most of the you guys are using the new style whiteboard. For this building, we'll be using whiteboard or traditional chalkboard?
We will be using whiteboard for this building.
I don't want to hear this.
Sorry.
If it's any comfort, I've been doing this for 20 years, and that question comes up at every single building. So the decision has been made to go whiteboard. Sorry.
Lasso Liptak, Department of Mathematics and Statistics. I first want to reiterate Joe Rager's concern about being able to organize the room so that you can have exams, where the students individually take exams. My other concern is not really for you, but the administration. I foresee difficulty having our common final exams because we very much depended on having large rooms. In last years, we barely had enough proctors to just have one proctor in each room for our common finals. So with losing so many large rooms, there might be a need for some alternate arrangements. I don't know. Maybe the gym?
Okay. Yeah, Bob Van Til, Industrial and Systems Engineering. Keep the collaborative space.
It is huge. Walk into the engineering school. Our students love it. Walk through the building and say, what's your major? What's your major? Psych, business, whatever. Our business, our school, you know, walls, it's Soviet style. You walk down the hallway and it's all brick and I can't see any light and whatever. This is great coming here to study. We like this. Faculty perspective. Faculty who are teaching in buildings like that. They come over and they teach their first one in one of our few classrooms. We don't have any. And I get it at the end of the semester. Can I get my class in that building next year? I'm walking up to class and my students are in the collaborative space getting ready for class. And after class, they're going there and they're working together. And it's just affecting the whole class is running better because they just naturally collaborate. They don't have to go out of their way. The students are happy. The faculty are happy. That space has to stay. You can't have enough of that space.
Yeah, we absolutely think the collaborative space is important. So much of the student work and group work and just, you know, learning in general happens outside of the classroom, and those spaces are crucial. The other thing we've heard is that currently in the existing building, you know, as students are waiting to go into classes and coming out of classes, it's just kind of a line of students against the hall or sitting on the floor. So that's why, part of why we took the initiative to really spread those spaces out along the corridor as well, so that we can sort of kind of give them a space to wait instead of crowding by doors and you know, laying across hallway floors as they're waiting to get into their classes. So thank you.
Tricia, did you have something to add? Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello. Hopefully when you came in, you picked up our list of tactics. I'm Tricia Westergaard, the registrar, and I'm going to turn it over to Chris Goeth, the associate registrar, to talk through some of the key strategies just really quickly with the tactics we're proposing during the construction period to handle the schedule of classes production that you're working on actively right now. And that's basically what we wanted to give you an update of how we're trying to handle the construction period.
Good afternoon. I'll keep it brief. The outline's a little bit more specific, but obviously this is very much in development, so we encourage your feedback as you hear about these. Here's a quick summary. We are proposing that there's some additional little classroom sharing, so you might have heard of this through hybrid courses. So ultimately the goal there is to split a class 50% online, 50% in person. That means two classes can share the room, and we know that there is some work already being done in the schedule to make that happen, so we're excited to hear that. Increasing online instruction where it's appropriate and available, if a department's already doing that, working together internally and with e-learning to accommodate that. Then, of course, our time module. So we have a primary, secondary time module that is approved by the Senate, and we are promoting that the primary time should be focused on this year and into the 18 months to facilitate the best logistics for the classroom space as well as student registration. And then with secondary time, keeping those minimal to true needs to the teaching style. Out of module is really tough to schedule with that amount of capacity missing, so there'd be very limited flexibility to make that happen. Of course, where there's need, we can work with you individually, but it will need to be minimized because the capacity just doesn't exist for the amount that we have right now. Of course, Friday with the hybrid option, Friday could become available as well as the Saturday option. So if there's any opportunities there, we do have space available that requires really no additional arrangements to make that there. It is there now. So some of that will also be increasing non-general purpose space. So that could include something as like conference rooms as well. The registrar's conference room could be retrofitted temporarily to accommodate a small seminar-style room. So that's one example. But other spaces that are more or less a classroom layout that could be easily converted with classroom supports assistance to make sure the technology and needs are there, but using spaces that traditionally aren't used for classes now so that we can offer some of that capacity for in-person instruction. Then, of course, there's already off-site locations in Macomb, Anton Frankel, and possible other locations depending on what the needs are. So obviously there's kind of a tiered approach to what we want to do, and then if we need to keep going, we have other options that are available. And then obviously, as a last case, temporary instructions possibly could be used for that. We're trying to avoid that if possible. But obviously, we have to consider all options.
So our biggest call to action today is that we need you. This is a campus-wide. It is going to be short-term. It's an 18-month construction project, but we're all going to have to work together to do our best. And I just want to thank all of you in advance for the challenge that I know that we're all going to go through during this period. And I think that it'll be well worth it on the other side. But we are grateful for all of you and the hard work you're putting into your schedule, as well as identifying spaces, some non-traditional spaces that we could perhaps use during this period. And we're here. We can come meet with your departments. We're meeting with chairs. We're meeting with associate deans. We're more than happy to come and talk with different groups to help through this process as we build the 2021 schedule. So with that, if you have any questions, I'm more than happy to answer them. We've got the team up here. Great. Thank you.
Thanks very much. So transitioning to the next item, strategic enrollment management, which I hope all of you have heard about in the room. I know some of you are new to this body, but we've talked about it here. Just my quick framing of it, as Dawn is putting this up on the screen, we are noticing, again, you've heard me talk about enrollment in the state. As we see numbers coming in from our sister institutions, State of Michigan is still in this decline mode for the birth rates of 18-year-olds graduating from high school. This is going to go on through about 2030, 2032, as projected. So what this means for us is getting new students, freshmen, let's say, at OU is becoming more and more challenging. Now, I can tell you, I won't steal anything Dawn's going to say, enrollment management has done a very nice job of bringing in new students. Compared to the other institutions in the state. So one of the challenges we're seeing right now, and we'll talk more about some numbers as Dawn unfolds this, is returning students. So I'm talking about sophomores, juniors, seniors, who, for whatever reason, if they don't return, that's affecting our overall enrollment number. So while I think what you're going to see is our new student, which includes freshmen and transfers together, are actually slightly up, which is remarkable in this environment, the returning number is somewhat down. So we're still beating the trend. We're still in relatively good shape. But this has risen to, with a SEM plan that we have, an all-university effort. So we're going to continue to reach out to you, department chairs, faculty members, deans, others, as we continually think about what we can do to make sure that enrollment stays healthy at OU in these difficult years for the state. So, Dawn?
Sure. Good afternoon, and thank you for giving me a few minutes to provide an update on the strategic enrollment management plan and to also just echo what the provost has said. We were able to meet in East Lansing last week with our sister institutions, the other 14 public enrollment and admissions directors, and it was a pretty depressing meeting. Pretty much almost everybody was down in freshmen with the exception of Michigan and Michigan State. And as you know, those are national universities. They will not experience the same type of challenges that Oakland and most of the other publics are facing. Transfers are a very different story. Oakland University actually is the second leader in transfer enrollment this year. We were about number 7, I think, about last year. So we came up. We're about 7% up this fall. So I will say give yourselves a round of applause because a lot of faculty worked hard to institute 20 new transfer articulations. So thank you very much for that. We are seeing a difference. The other thing that I would let you know is that the folks that did end up in the positive Ferris State, it was by 9 students. And why? They have lots of online and hybrid programs. They don't offer everything in a traditional format. So that is my advice to you, is to think about that. That is the one leader other than Michigan and Michigan State. I wanted to just quickly talk to you about strategic enrollment management and let you know that we wanted to share the progress and give an opportunity if you have any questions today. As the provost has already stated, this is just another example of what we're experiencing. And of course, it's not just with high school students. It affects our community college students because they were traditional students who moved on to the community college. So we are seeing declines in most of our community college institutions. I will tell you, I met with OCC about 2 days ago, and they told me they think they're up 200 students. So as long as they can maintain that, that is a good sign for us because most of their transfer students do come to Oakland University, and Michigan State, I think, is their number two partner school. In terms of freshmen, we've been bucking the trend. We had record number of undergraduate applications this fall and a record number of offers for admission, but we are just slightly down from last year. Last year, we had 2,700 freshmen. We're about 15 students down. So hopefully, official count date is next week on the 25th. We'll be able to maintain that. It looks pretty good. In terms of transfer, this year, we are a little bit, a lot of 7% up. We're about 1,490 incoming, or actually 1,500 incoming freshmen or incoming transfer. And Wayne State had a significant decline, but they still top us. They're about 1,600 transfer students, so darn. But they know we're catching up to them, and so I want to show them next year for sure we're going to exceed their transfer goal. In terms of graduate students, you know, our graduate school has been really working hard to make sure we're matriculating more students. You can see from their history, we had some drops in applications. Admits have been pretty steady. And enrollment. So again, today we had to cancel some students for non-payment. It was very minimal. It was about 40 students. We saved most of the grad students, so I can tell you that. And those students can register and get back in their classes if they take care of their payment. Tricia Westergaard is on it, and she's working real close with Cindy Hermson and our student business services. So that's pretty good to only have to drop 40 students, and we want all of them back. This is our biggest concern, clearly, is the current student decline. And so the SEM plan is really looking at ways that we can increase retention. Ann Hitt and Omar Brownell are leading our student success and retention committee. And Susan Aubrey and Julia Smith are leading the retention efforts at the graduate level. So we've been really working hard to understand why students aren't returning and what we could do. Some of it obviously is financial. Sometimes there are things, though, that happen when they're here that are outside of that financial realm and they decide not to re-enroll. And we need your help to find out what those things are. The Strategic Enrollment Management Plan will help us. The good part of some of our decline is that we're graduating more students, which that, of course, is wonderful to actually help them complete their degree. That's not always great for revenue, though. You know, of course, those students won't be paying their, to come here, but maybe we can get them to go to graduate school, right, or add a certificate. So we recognize you're on the front line of meeting this increasingly important retention imperative, and we welcome your feedback and ideas of what we can do to be friendlier. I can guarantee you, as the leader in the enrollment management area, I am working closely with my staff to make sure we're looking and identifying any enrollment barriers and addressing some of the policies that maybe need to be changed and some of the processes that need to be changed. And I've gotten lots of calls from some of you in this room, and don't hesitate, let me know if there are other things, because we are working aggressively to change that. SEM, as most of you know, is a strategic enrollment management process that is very intentional. It is to help us realize our optimal goal. Oakland University several years ago used to tell everyone they wanted to be at 25,000 students. You know, I'm going to tell you that is probably not a realistic goal in these conditions, but if we decided to change some of the ways that we're doing things, we might be able to actually increase more aggressively. And our group has been having great conversations, everything from how do we become more financially efficient, how do we identify those barriers that I mentioned, and what are we doing to communicate and market to students? Today I had a dean share with me his perspective as a parent of a student, a current student, and also as a parent of a prospective student. And the vast difference from the emails and messaging and view books they get when we're recruiting a student compared to when they come here, right? And when they attend. And there's a very vast difference in how we talk to students. And so we need to, as a university, change the way and understand that students want segmented communications directly to them for the purpose that is for their needs. We cannot treat everyone the same. They don't respond to mass emails, just like you probably don't respond to mass emails. We live in an Amazon world. So we need to continue to collaborate. And we also will be doing that through the framework that we have. This hopefully is review for some of you. We have an executive team, which our cabinet serves in that role. Our steering team is Dr. Lentini, Glenn McIntosh, John Young, John Bean, and then all the co-chairs of our various committees that are faculty and staff. We have a recruitment council, the Council for Innovation and Entrepreneurial Education. Notice the name change. We used to call this the credit generation team. We decided it was more than just credit generation. And then the Student Success and Retention Council. And while the Student Success and Retention Council largely was focusing on undergraduate retention and success, we decided to make sure we had a very robust graduate recruitment and retention committee, and then also an international recruitment and retention committee. So we have all of these groups working in tandem. We're having a lot of different cross-functional team meetings to make sure we're capturing everything we can. We're collecting data, we're evaluating that data, and we're actually into the next set of steps here. So we're moving from developing this plan. We have key enrollment indicators, collecting in data, and analyzing the data, putting them into goals, also talking about infrastructure, what do we need, developing strategies. Most of our committees are in that phase, and now we're also discussing tactical work. And so number six, you can see number five and number six is sort of, I would say, our main areas that we're at the stage that we're at right now. Something I think I might have shared with a few different units that have seen me present lately is we wanted to show folks what it would look like if we projected to increase or maintain certain numbers for enrollment. So, for example, in our projection number one for the university, what if we were to maintain this fall's headcount? So if we're at 2673 and we maintain that the next 5 years, knowing that the market is kind of declining aggressively around us, okay? That is not easy for the admissions office to do. That is not easy for financial aid and for faculty to do that, but what if we say we're going to maintain, okay? Then what if we say we're going to maintain a new transfer headcount of 1,195? Now, this, I will tell you, is pure transfer. When I just told you we about 1,500 transfer, the way that we count in our U1s through U5s, we have other degree-seeking students, that would be about maintaining what we're doing as well. The new grad goal right now, they were setting at 8.77%. That's within the next 5 years. We might change that depending on what we come in next week. And international, what if we increase 10%? So has anyone been looking in the media? How easy is it to get a visa these days? Okay. So these things, why I'm telling you, we're saying projection right now. We're watching what's going on, and we will be adjusting this. Some of our committees are having fun with me because I tell them it depends, you know, and they're really trying hard to give us some targets and help us with these overall projections. But we are looking at all of these types of scenarios. The last one you see, 83% freshman retention rate. Anybody know what our first-year retention rate is for this fall?
About 75.
76, I think, 76%. So to go from 76 to 83 in the next 5 years is a pretty large goal. So what are we going to do, right? What are we going to do? That's what these groups are showing us. How do we go from, you know, 19.3, which now today we're at about 19.43 in our current enrollment after adding and dropping some students. Tomorrow we might hopefully be up a little. But we don't want to go to 18,150, right? So we're nervous. If we just sit here and just do what we've always done, that's where we're going to be in fall 2025. But if we have some of the goals, strategies, and tactics that we're discussing, we want to be around 19,373 in 5 years. I have some other scenarios. I won't go into the details because I want to be mindful of time, but you can see how we're playing with different projections with different audiences to help us come out with positive outcomes. And this one was real aggressive where we'd go to 19,900. Okay, that one sounds a lot better, right? Sounds like we have a much more revenue. We could hire more faculty. You know, we could hopefully hire some more tutors for students, et cetera. So this is definitely what I think our team wants us to move in the direction of, saying we can increase our enrollment during these challenging times, but that we're going to have to start doing business differently at the university, and we're going to have to be very creative. And I encourage everyone in this room, if you're not already discussing this in department meetings, is, you know, how could we offer our curriculum in different ways, or are we utilizing some of the ways that are available to us? So how many of you are looking at 8-week formats? How many of you are looking at going online or hybrid? How many of you are thinking about capturing adult learners at Oakland University? And when I say adult learners, it's 25 year and older. One great example, the RN to BSN has record enrollment this fall, and they're being really responsive to the adult learner. These are obviously folks working in nursing already, but were told by their employer they needed to be earning that degree in a couple years or they wouldn't have a job. They're a very motivated group, right? Some of you don't have audiences like that, but do we know of industry? Do we know of local businesses that would partner with us? Do they have uncredentialed workforce? You know, do we have people that we could convince them it's a good idea to earn the bachelor's degree or to even secure a certificate? I know School of Engineering and Computer Science is working very closely with Lori Kroos, and I would encourage those ways of thinking, because sometimes somebody gets a certificate or has a good experience, they might decide to return for a degree. You know, so those are the kind of things we're asking you to think about, and you're going to see very soon, if you look at our timeline and process, we will be having an open house on November 19th, and I invite all of you to come to learn about the work that we're doing as we finalize our plan to be released to the whole community by the end of the year. So in December, we want to have this out to the whole entire community, but we need the last final touches with you coming on November 19th from 8:30 to 1. You can stop in for a few minutes and see some of the work. You can also sit for the presentation. We will have our ACRO consultant, Betty Huff, attending as well. And she's been at many campuses, and she's told me she's very impressed with the ideas that are generated from our faculty and staff. And I can just tell you, I've never seen us work so collaboratively before. It's probably one of my best moments at Oakland in my 22 years, is watching faculty and staff tackling these challenging issues and coming up with creative solutions. So again, I want to thank you and open it up to anyone who has any questions about strategic enrollment management or even the enrollment management area. And Trisha's here in the audience. I think she wanted me to give a plug. If you're not using Platinum Analytics and you're a department chair, we're excited. We're going to be offering more trainings. We need to do a better job on capacity and scheduling planning. So please come and sign up for a session. If you see Cindy Hermson and you're the person who helps with scholarship selection, we're going to have an amazing new tool launched in April to help you with current student scholarships. And we'll have a dashboard. It's going to be amazing. The other thing is admissions. If you see them, please give them a high five. They're already on the road recruiting the next 3 years of classes. And, of course, our graduate school, too. I think everyone, you know, we just got everyone here, and we're back out trying to get ready for winter, summer, and next fall. So give them a shout out, and we're really excited to work with you. Yes, Ron.
Dawn. I know one of the big problems has always been We have students who come here with the intention of leaving after a year.
Yes.
They just come, I'm going to get started here locally, and now I want to go to Michigan, Michigan State, wherever. That is awful hard to fight.
It is.
Have you given any thought about it?
We have. The one good thing I can tell you is looking at National Student Clearinghouse data, which will come available to me in about 3.5 to 4 weeks, is I will look at that to see if I notice any changes. Anyone want to guess who our number one competitor who we lose those students to? Current students, not just the new students.
MSU.
Michigan State, yes. So you are so right, Ron, and part of it's where we're located. And when the economy's good, some of the students who live right here in our backyard, they might decide to go there. I will also tell you, though, Michigan State is having a hard time getting out of state and international students. So they're going to pick up more of these freshmen right off the bat. So a lot of those students won't even come to Oakland to begin with. So we're also facing that. My biggest fighter of that, I think, is that when they come here, we have to make them have an amazing experience. And I think you all are key to that. Our faculty and staff, I think, are very personable. They're experts in their field. And if they can show the students what they can do here at Oakland and how that's different than what they're going to do at Michigan State, that's one way to combat it. The other thing is our financial aid. Our financial aid and scholarships. That is one way we have definitely been a competitor to Michigan State. And I'm going to tell you right now, and I think the provost knows that we're working with Ruffin O'Levitz on our financial aid optimization. And one of the key factors is we have to look at the students that leave and those that choose to come here and why. And a lot of it is that affordability issue. And if we're able to be able to offset some of those costs with a merit award or even a need-based award, that can change that student's decision. So that would be my advice. Any other questions, comments?
It's like we have one coming to the microphone. Yes.
Karen Miller. We have these unknown, we don't know why they leave. Two questions. Number one, what efforts are we making other than asking us to figure it out? What efforts are we making to figure out who these people are? And do we at least have demographics on them? Are they out of area? Are they in area? Is it high school background? Is it race, ethnicity, first generation? Do we have anything that we know about this 13% unknown? Because it's...
Yep. Actually, we do. We know quite a bit. And Song and Ruben are back there shaking their heads. One of the most powerful tools that we have is using the data that we have and being able to share it. And today I was with the School of Nursing, and they were talking to me about some of the frustration. They do faculty feedback, for example. And then what are the reports? How can folks know what's going on when they give us that feedback? How could we utilize that to help you make better decisions? Like, do you intervene? Do you call a student into your office? Do you know if an academic advisor is meeting and talking to them or a financial advisor? You know, are they being referred to counseling? These are really important things to do, and we are really trying to drill down. And part of the Student Success and Retention Group is looking at why they leave. One thing I will tell you, and I hope this comes out in the SEM report, I will encourage it, is we do not do exit surveys. We do not always know why somebody leaves because we don't collect that information. A lot of it, though, is we have clues and we have actions that students do that we could be collecting earlier. One thing Tricia and I have been talking about is when a student requests their transcript and they've only been here for 3 weeks, that's a clue, right? They're not applying for graduate school when they're a new freshman or a new transfer. So what could we do differently? Is it the registrar that should reach out to that student? They're like, why is the registrar calling me? Is that maybe an academic advisor? You know, is it a residence hall director? There could be a variety of tactics we could use. That's part of exactly this with SEM, is we're trying to find out what kind of action should we be taking. We all know when we look at national research of other schools, and we've probably all heard about Georgia State, right? Georgia State is one of the most well-known institutions, is they've changed their business using data to then inform their decision-making. So for me, we're not Georgia State. We don't have 87 institutional effectiveness experts, but we do have maybe 7 that are pretty awesome, and we have a lot of us that are pretty smart, and we could start using our own data to help that. And I definitely don't want to say to faculty, I expect you all to figure this all out on your own, but sometimes you see things and hear things, and you know something's not right. And so if you can let the people know, especially myself, Trisha, Cindy, Song and Ruben, we then can sometimes take a deeper dive and look at what might be going on. I think a lot of faculty will send me student names of what's going on, and then there's always more to the story, and usually we can find out how this student could have been helped, and then we can change their trajectory here. But we are doing a lot of collecting data and analyzing, and sometimes I have to say to the provost, we're going to need more resources. Right now, text messaging is something we're going to be using to nudge students. And while that might just seem like, wow, we should have probably been doing that 7 years ago, yes, but it's not as simple as you think. There's a lot of different things you got to do, and you can't over-text someone, and you want to be segmented and intentional in the right way. So those are some things, if hopefully that gives you an example of what we're trying to do differently.
I would just add to that. So yes, Karen asked a good question. We have a lot of data and certainly ideas and concrete things of why we think students are leaving. What we need are the extra layers to try and see if there are perspectives that we're not seeing that certainly faculty, staff, others can help us identify.
I get a lot of letters from alumni who tell me about their children's experience, if you can believe that. And I'm an alumni, so sometimes those letters aren't very good. And a lot of times you find out one thing happens, which then leads to another thing that leads to another. And, you know, what I'm trying to do is talk to those people and find out, and then circle back to maybe some of the folks they interacted with to see what could we have done differently. And we all know that when you talk to a student, sometimes their perception, you know, it becomes their reality. So I think in a lot of things, as we've grown at Oakland, some of our infrastructure did not grow, right? We didn't always have the support services probably that are necessary. So now we need to think about what do we do differently so we can support these folks through. And I think one of the things I can tell you, I ask my staff all the time, is this process supporting students through to graduation? Are we filtering students out? And a lot of times at a university, we filter students out. So that has to be part of the SEM plan, that we're changing our culture and making sure we are supporting them through to graduation. And maybe it means that we have to do things differently than we've done before, but I think we can do it. And I'm seeing lots of signs that other faculty and staff on these teams are recognizing that, and they're working together to move us forward. And many other schools are calling us to find out how we're getting faculty on committees to do this. So that is a testament, too, that I don't think I've had anyone kick and scream to say they didn't want to be part of this, which that's a good sign. Anyone else?
Thanks, Dawn. I think we should probably move it forward. This is not the last time you hear about strategic enrollment management. So
it won't
you.
Be. Yeah. I'll be back. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Dawn. Scott? I got Scott Kunzelman here with a team of folks to talk about youth protection policy. Thanks for your patience.
He's going to walk in front of the panel. That's really good. Yeah.
I'm bringing up the whole team.
Holy smokes. Half the group.
Some of them more reluctantly than others. Can you guys hear me okay? All right. First of all, thank you for hosting us and taking a look at our new youth program protection policy. What I'd like to do kind of as an opener is first introduce you to the task force that was really brought together to get us to this point. And then what I'll do is highlight some background. So there's some important background on this topic that I think is worth going through. I think without further ado, I should have the team introduce themselves just and highlight where they're from, because this was a pretty broad collaborative effort that got us to this point. I want to make sure they get credit for that.
All right, I'll start. I'm Ron Watson. I'm the
Mark Gordon, the police chief.
Keith Howard from the Office of Legal Affairs.
Anita Hicks, I'm the associate director of the Oakland Center, and I also have oversight of camps and conferences.
Michelle Piskulich, academic affairs, and we also work in camps through PACE.
Joy Cunningham, academic human resources.
Chad Martinez, diversity, equity, inclusion, and Title IX coordination.
Chris Colbus, School of Engineering and Computer Science. I also wear the hat of director for outreach, so K through 12 STEM camps, summer camps, field trips, Saturday programs throughout the school year. Been working with that for about 10 years.
And we have a couple folks who couldn't be here today, but hopefully we'll be able to field your questions adequately. And of course, I should have mentioned, my name is Scott Kunstelman. I'm the Chief Operating Officer, and I was tasked with addressing this topic. And of course, the first thing we did was pull together this team. But let me walk through a little bit of history just so that the idea of youth protection on campuses makes sense holistically and what's gone on here in the past. Some of this you may not be completely familiar with, so I'll go quickly. In terms of OU's background on this topic, in 2012, after issues occurred at Penn State that I think you're all familiar with, a youth protection team was formed here. That led to a draft policy that was never issued, but what was established was a website. In 2013, a website was established, and annual reminders set out holistically, but also to those who we knew who were running camps. And this was really to help guide camp sponsors to this site for instructions on some of the standardized processes that were we were following. In August of 2017, we had an alarming situation, honestly, here on our own campus, where an accused child predator had spent some time in our own Lowry Center. The internal investigation that went on that followed that, it completed in the winter of 2018, and specifically requested as a outcome of that investigation was an audit of our youth program delivery across campus. So that audit was completed in October of 2018, approaching a year ago, with actually several unsatisfactory findings, and then led to many recommendations, not the least of which was the establishment of a formal youth protection policy. And quite frankly, there's been a lot of activity at our peers in a similar time frame, and I think, again, fueled by some of the other things that were going on at peer institutions like Michigan State. So it was kind of easy to get benchmark information based on everything that was happening. It was timely. The task force was immediately named for the purpose of completing this, and work began in earnest, and you just met the majority of our team. Just to give you an idea what some of the activities included, for one, reviving the prior policy draft, which is actually was a pretty good starting point, benchmarking numerous institutions. Again, there was a lot of more recent activity. A lot of institutions had recently put in their own policies. And in many cases, we're sponsoring webinars. So our time, it was very fortuitous for us to be able to participate on some webinars on these subject matter. And quite frankly, it highlighted to us that we were behind on getting there. We also held several internal town hall meetings with the people that we knew were administering youth programs to try to understand issues that could come up in this process and some of the enablers. The results, essentially, of all this were reviewed and presented for approval along the way. And between March and August of this year, that included venues, both reviews and approval venues. It included the Board of Trustees Audit Committee, Academic Council, the Provost Council, Administrative Council, and the Cabinet. And so this is a key step along the way, of course, to have this group provide feedback. What I should also highlight, in addition to and in parallel to the policy requirements, processes have been developed for training, for registering programs, for completing background checks. In fact, we have a new vendor on board now for background checks. And these are all largely accessible. These processes are largely accessible on the updated website. The website is still in existence and is a resource for guidance and works in parallel with the policy. We're also in the process of hiring an overall policy compliance administrator who will be within the OUPD as a starting point. We also discussed that because this is an evolving topic for us, we'll be taking a one-year-in look at anything we need to change, including kind of where we administer. So it's my understanding, I think, that the policy was provided as part of materials for today's meeting. And with that, I think rather than go into it in more detail, maybe the best thing to do is open up for questions, clarifications, or input. Any questions? Don't be shy. I know you're not a shy group.
Looks like they're satisfied, Scott. So
okay. All right. Well, thank you. Again, a lot of the your areas participated along the way, and we really appreciate how collaborative an effort this was. I think it's important for Oakland to have made this step. So thank you.
Thanks very much. We don't want to lose a quorum, so I'm going to speak quickly for provost updates. Couple of things. We talked about South Foundation Hall. We all know we have some space needs on campus. So one of the things you may have heard of if you've attended a board meeting or looked at any of the board documentation is we're in the process of purchasing a building across Squirrel, 3300 University Avenue, which is 128,000 square foot space that has high bays, could accommodate lots of research, engineering, heavy equipment, that sort of thing. It's still in process. It's not a done deal, but it's very far into the process. And we're hopeful to allow that. We're hopeful it will come to fruition, which could allow us to free up some space on campus, quite frankly, which would then allow us to reconfigure some vacated spaces to do just what you're talking about, more teaching spaces, more labs, that sort of thing on our own campus while also accommodating across the way. I wanted you to know about it. There will be more information coming as this goes forward. There's a Wilson Hall project as well, which is it's not as far along certainly as South Foundation Hall. It's still in the planning stages. Student services could free up some other spaces on campus as well. We're looking to do everything we can to increase the number of faculty offices. This will be an ongoing challenge for the university, but with these three projects would really help us jumpstart a way to some improved space options for the campus. So those are some other major things going on. With that, I'm going to move us on to roll call.
Julia Alexander. Dan Alloy.
Here.
Zena El Salman. Kevin Ball. Liz Barclay. Megan Berry. Paul Battle. Keith Bourbon, Adolfo Campoy Cubillo, Esel Chesmelioglu, Louis Chamra, Eddie Cheng, Dan Clark, Kevin Corcoran, John Corso, Claudio Cortez, Kares Dean, Debatash Debna, Judy Didion, Sumi Dinda, Tom DeSena, Deborah Doherty, Chaturi Edrasina, Susan El-Sayed, Alan Epstein, Todd Estes, Ellen Gajewski, David Garfinkel, Mina Gobriel, Frank Giblin, Henry Gorin, Lila Gessus, Kelly Hay, Mariella Hristova, Mark Iskin, Barbara Joyce, Michelle Knox, Laura Landholt, Mike Lacha,
here.
Jennifer Law Sullivan, Todd Liebert, Laszlo Liptek,
here.
Mike Long, John Marjoram Lace, Michael Mazio, Gwen McMillan, did you say here? Okay, here present. John Meldrum, Aaron Myers,
here.
Dwayne Meswa, Karen Miller, Mohinder Parkesh,
here.
Julia Paul, Padia Petrescu,
yeah.
Joe Rieger,
here.
Julia Rodriguez, Yaman Rumani, Destiny Rule, Scott Teagues, Ron Tracy,
present.
Bob Van Til, here. Mike Wadsworth, Dao Qi Zhang. Okay, well, there is a quorum.
Thank you. Okay. So you were provided the minutes of May 9th, 2019. Are there any
suggested changes to minutes? Seeing none, we'll approve the minutes as presented. Thank you very much. We're going to move on to an election. Before we do it, I did want to mention a thank you to the steering committee from this past year, Andrea Ice. I know has been doing this a while, and we appreciate everything you've done. Dan Alloy, Becca Cheesham, Beth Wallace, Ron Tracy, Mark Rigstead. Can we just give them a round of applause for all the work they've done? So with that, I invite the election committee to come up.
Joe Rieger, I am the chair of the election committee, and since your eyes are all tired, I'm going to read the paragraph on the agenda in front of you about what this election will be like. At the first meeting of the new Senate, the Constitution calls for the election of 6 senators to the Senate Steering Committee for a term of 2 years. The only limitation on the electability of senators to the committee is that no more than 2 may be elected from any organized 1 faculty. The steering committee normally meets on the first and third Tuesdays of each month from 1 to 3 to set the Senate agenda, refer business to the Senate committees, and receive reports from those bodies, and advise the Senate on governance issues. It occasionally meets during the summer, yay. And if you wish to nominate someone, please establish in advance the person is willing to serve. At this time, I would like to open nominations for the Senate Steering Committee. Mike. I recognize Mike.
I would like to nominate Dan Alloy.
Okay. My associate is going to type out the names as you say them. Other nominations?
Laura Landel from Political Science. I nominate Aaron Myers.
Aaron Myers. Okay. Great.
Liz Barkley from the SBA. I nominate Ron Tracy.
Ron Tracy, he agrees. Okay. Others? We need 3 more people. It's really fun. I did it once. You get pizza and ice cream at the meetings. And the provost gives back rubs to everybody who does it.
It's supposed to be secret.
Oh, sorry. That's a secret. As he plays on his guitar, he gives you a back rub, so it's beautiful. Anybody else? We need 3 more people. Oh, Mike.
To nominate Tom DeSena.
Tom DeSena, are you willing? Tom says yes. Number 4. Got a colleague that's been bothering you? You want to nominate them?
Yeah, who's not here?
I mean, a colleague that you admire, you want to nominate them? Any other nominations?
I have not asked somebody, but I would like to nominate Eddie Chang.
Eddie Chang?
I have to decline because I have to teach at the time.
Bummer.
Oh. Good excuse, Eddie.
You can self-nominate.
It doesn't have to just be faculty. It can be students. We have student representatives on Senate. And it can be staff. It can be administrators. Can it be administrators?
As long as they're a member of the Senate.
Okay. If anyone who's a member of the Senate.
Could be a short meeting or a long meeting.
I think we're thinking it might have to be faculty. I should know. But I
don't know. I've never had a precedent. If anyone needs a $10 bill,
this is a first time. Yeah, $10 bills. The provost will give you a $10 bill, a massage, and a concert.
It's getting a little weird. Be careful.
I don't know why I'm not volunteering myself. This is so fabulous, but I actually have a commitment during that time. You get to help, like, set policy and ask questions and anybody else.
I'm recruiting.
Yes, Ron.
Again, I have not asked this person, but I've worked with her. She's very good. Karen Miller.
Karen Miller, are you willing?
I would be willing, but I teach at 1 o'clock.
Mm. We can move your class for you. Trisha, what can we give Karen here?
Yeah, it's true.
Trisha will come and carry you to and from your classroom.
She will.
She knows a lot of history. Okay. I thought I saw someone else had a hand up, maybe thinking. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Ellen Gajewski.
Ellen, are you willing? Brave soul. Okay, we need one more person. Anyone else? You might be shy, so maybe somebody needs to look at you and just throw your name out there, and then you can get your pizza, your ice cream, your concert, your back rub, and your $10 bill.
The things keep going up.
I know. One more person. You don't get to leave. How about this? Nobody leaves until one more person's name's up there.
We've never had it this bad. Never.
It can't be from the college because...
unless we have seven.
Okay. We have two from the college, so we're good there.
Layla, would you like to be...
I nominate Layla.
Can we put her on and replace her in the winter? Yeah. If you're willing, we can put you on and replace you in the winter. And you'll be carried to and from your classroom by the registrar's office. There's actually no pressure, and I actually told Layla not to volunteer for this. So.
If nobody volunteers.
I see Laura Landaltz raising her hand.
Laura. I'm trying to check the schedule, and I believe that I do not teach during that time, but I hear on Tuesday, Thursday, so.
There we go.
Here's the problem. Laura's from the college.
I nominate Julia Rodriguez.
Julia Rodriguez, are you willing? She says, I guess so.
That's
interesting. Woo-hoo! Free textbooks for everyone because of Julia. There we go. Okay. Okay. Can I get a motion to close the nominations?
Don't move.
You want this to end. All in favor of the slate that we have in front of us, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? I didn't think so. Any abstaining? Okay, great. We have the Senate for next year. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. If we need to change those perks, which it sounds like we do, let's talk about that. I would invite that group to come up, except we don't have much to do. Well, come up anyway. Come on up.
Yeah, there's empty
seats. $10. All right, checking my wallet.
You want to take it? Take yours.
We actually have to see what size chairs we need for them, so we...
Okay.
us of internet.
Well, there aren't enough for more. Oh, there's one down there.
That's why I wanted Depitage.
We need one for Julia. Julia, BYOC.
There's another chair.
Oh, there's another chair down there? Oh, never mind.
All right.
All right. Well, we appreciate everyone being willing to serve. Thank you very much. So I will move on to the next item, which we are removing from the agenda. There was a flurry of discussion, and the parties involved in the proposal from Graduate Council agreed to remove this item. We're planning on bringing it to October meeting. We think we can do that. So thank you very much. For what is listed here as item three, this is a procedural motion, and this is to staff our Senate standing committees. So it is moved that persons listed be appointed to the committees or positions designated. Any discussion?
I have a question on why some of these terms have been extended.
Michelle, is Michelle here? We did talk about this, Michelle, about why we had the 3 years.
At one of the last, I think the April meeting or the May meeting, and I'm sorry, I do not recall precisely. It must have been May. The Senate extended the term for the Academic Conduct Committee. And so at the steering committee's direction, I reached out to the newly appointed members of the Academic Conduct Committee and asked which ones might voluntarily agree to the lengthened term. And these were the people who said yes. And what I would say is that I also let them know that, you know, of course, if things change, there's no penalties currently for people stepping off a committee early. We could change that if we wanted, but right now this is the way we do it. So
it's really easy to get people on committees, Matt. Any other discussion? All right, I'll take a vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstain. Thank you. We are on to good and welfare. Any items in good and welfare? Seeing none, without objection, go enjoy sunshine. Hopefully it's still out there, and we will see you in October. Thank you.